Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Stephanie McFeeters, the deputy editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative, and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we are working on, many of which you have likely read in your local newspapers or on our website. For more information on our work and how to support the Maine Monitor, please visit www.themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by Alexa Faust, who was a fellow at the Maine Monitor this summer through the Institute for Nonprofit News and Columbia Journalism School Fellowship Program. She reported several stories for us on mental health and public safety. Today, we're going to focus on a recent investigative report she did in conjunction with the Center for Public Integrity that looked at safety violations at childcare facilities across Maine. So, Alexa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Before we dive in, can you tell listeners a little bit about your background and why you were interested in working with us at the Monitor this summer?
Yeah, of course. So I recently graduated from Columbia Journalism School in May of 2024. And while I was there, I focused a lot of my classwork on investigative reporting and accountability reporting. So as time came around to graduate, I was looking for publications that really focused on that and kind of had what I love about journalism is that accountability aspect. So I read up on the Maine Monitor, and you guys have a great fellowship program with the Columbia J School. So I thought it would be a good fit. I think kind of the important part of journalism is the accountability aspect that we can bring kind of an educational light to some readers about different aspects that they might not be aware of. So that's how I ended up here.
Great. Well, we were thrilled to have you working with us this summer. And, you know, all of the work you did was really great, but especially this latest investigation, which I know took months of time and a lot of really hard work. And I think it really is exactly that kind of accountability journalism that you're talking about and really sort of, you know, shines a light on an issue that people weren't aware of. And the information was kind of hard to access and hard to digest. And, you know, you did what we always try to do with our work, which is you sort of really, you know, dug into it and then were able to present it to readers in a really accessible and interesting way. So can you tell us, you know, where did the idea for this story come from and how did you start approaching it?
Yeah, of course. So back in, I think it was early July, I had a meeting with Maine Monitor's other editor, Kate, and she had mentioned that she kind of always had this interest for a story, but hadn't had time to really give it the attention that it deserved. And she'd come across an inspection report for a child care facility in Maine that had some violations that she found interesting. And she wanted me to kind of just start out looking at inspection reports online. So in Maine, I think it was back in 2014, the Press Herald originally did an original series of articles on the child care industry in Maine and some of the faults within it. And they started through that process posting inspection reports that the state conducts with child care facilities online so that parents can access them and see any sort of violation that the facility may have been written up for. So I went on that website, I think it's called Child Searches Maine, Child Care Searches Maine, and looked up one inspection report and started cataloging just that one facility. And then I broadened it to that county, which was Hancock County. And then I met with Kate, and we originally thought that we were going to do kind of a shorter piece just on one or two facilities looking at their specific violations and what that means for those counties and the childcare issue in that specific town. But then when we started reading more and more of these inspection reports and realized that it was a larger issue, and something that I hadn't been touched on recently, we decided to go through every county in Maine and build out the database to kind of get a more holistic picture of it. So we decided to go county by county to kind of be able to then break it down further. We started with Hancock and wrote out separately all of the violations from each inspection report that was posted. So in Maine, you're supposed to have an inspection at least once annually at a facility or just a provider. So a lot of facilities may have only had three or four from when the inspection reports are available, which was back in 2021. Others had dozens. So it was opening up those PDF files and manually typing in the date of the inspection report. And any violations that occurred, and when their license was up for renewal, any licensing actions that had been taken against the facility, and any of that sort of thing. And yeah, that was the beginning process of diving in.
Well, it sounds like there was a lot to look at once you broadened it. Before we really dive into what that sort of cataloging and database building process looked like, can you just lay out for people who may not be familiar, what agency is responsible for overseeing these childcare facilities and these inspections? And you said they're done once a year. Tell us a little bit about that process, and then what these inspection reports really look like. And let's start with that.
Yeah, of course. So the state has a Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees all of childcare facilities and providers across the state. But within the Department of Health and Human Services, they have the Office of Child and Family Services, and they oversee licensing. So they have, I think it's about 18 licensing specialists who are tasked with overseeing the, I think it's a little over 1,500 facilities and providers across the state. And they are assigned specific facilities. And once a year, they will go unannounced to whatever facility they're assigned to. And basically, they have a checklist that they have to go through, or a sheet that they have to go through that has all the licensing and regulation requirements that the facility has to meet in order to be considered in compliance. They will initially do that when the facility is looking to become licensed. There's like an initial period where they can go and make sure and walk it through with the provider to make sure they understand what's required of them. And then they will be inspected once annually. But if a facility is found to be not in compliance, meaning they may have more violations, and they seem to be mounting, or someone has complained to the State Department, the Office of Child and Family Services, about a facility or an employee or something like that, they can go more frequently. So some facilities we saw had 30 some inspections over 3 years because the state was being more diligent with checking more frequently, to make sure they're coming into compliance. And the state will then post the inspection reports online for the public to see, but they're only made available for 3 years. So the ones that we could see were from 2021 onwards. And yeah, there's also something more serious that the state can do when doing inspections, which are directed plans of action, meaning that if, say, someone complains that an employee did something, or they suspect an employee of something, or they think the facility did something wrong, they can file a complaint with the State Department, and they will initiate like an out-of-home investigation and send someone to do a more thorough investigation that requires interviews between the State Department and parents and children and employees to kind of come to their own conclusion about what's going on, and make sure everything is up to regulations and nothing is awry. And that inspection reports and investigations are required to be posted within a facility so that all parents can see any violations that may have occurred. And then if a facility has a lot of repeat violations or any more serious violations that the state deems could be a harm to a child immediately, they can issue a conditional license, which is even more regulation that requires the facility. They give them a specific time frame where they have to meet X, Y, and Z so that they are not cited for any future violations. And those are that conditional license is also required to be posted within the facility for parents to see. And
What so when you when you're talking about these violations that might lead to further investigation or that might lead the state to issue a conditional license, what kinds of violations are we talking about here? What's sort of the range?
Violations in general can range from something small like staff manuals not including fire drill records, or staff not fully filling out attendance records, or missing immunization records. But then it can also range from things like rough handling children, or yelling at children, or using not positive methods of child guidance, which are kind of disciplinary methods that wouldn't be considered positive. So they can range from anything like that. Mostly what we saw is that through the investigation was the facilities that were being issued conditional licenses or were having more frequent inspections were those facilities or providers that were being written up for violations that more erred along the line of safety and health violations related to child safety and the general cleanliness of the facility. There was one facility that was written up dozens of times for health and safety violations related to trash and garbage in the facility, making it unsafe for children to be there, and things of that nature. The directed plans of action and conditional license are really used for those more safety and health violations versus the more standard procedural violations.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And I want to get into that division a bit more because I know that was something that you all really thought about. But before we get into that, let's go back to sort of you're starting to go through all these inspection reports. You're looking at all the counties now. You're downloading these PDFs. What are you looking at? What are you finding? And how are you starting to catalog all this information?
So I think kind of to backtrack, before we cataloged, we looked more deeply into the licensing procedures that the state conducts to kind of get a general sense of what is required of the facility to be up and running. And then once we kind of understood that and what facilities are needed to have certain amount of children, we then started to dig into the inspection reports. And we first were looking at First, we were kind of investigating whether or not inspections are conducted every year. Is the state up with their inspections, or are they falling behind? And that was what I went into the database thinking I was going to find a lot of, and I didn't. The state is pretty regularly conducting investigations or inspections. So that was kind of where we deterred into more like, okay, let's catalog everything to kind of get a more bird's eye view of like what the issue actually is. Like, yes, we know some facilities have these more safety violations that could harm a child's health or welfare, but what is like the bigger picture? So we zoomed out and we cataloged it by facility, city, county, and then we started to catalog when each violation was or when each inspection was occurring to kind of understand like how frequent things are happening And if things are, if violations are kind of mounting, is the state inspecting more often? Are there directed plans of actions or conditional license being issued? So then we would start cataloging if, or making a note in the database if a directed plan of action was issued, if the facility had a conditional license, to kind of see like the follow-up from the regulators on the issues. So that was kind of to get a more a broader picture of what was going on.
Great. And I know you worked with the Center for Public Integrity on this and co-wrote the story with Kate Hapgood from there. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that she did on the story and the sort of data perspective that she brought to it?
Yeah, it was great working with the Center for Public Integrity. I think we were pretty far along in the cataloging process of the downloading the PDFs and writing everything in when we started working with them. What was helpful for their perspective is they were able to come in and give us raw data on give us a number of that to put into perspective the actual issue. So how many violations are there? And Kate was able to say I think it was over 16,000 violations were found from 2021 to the present day. And she was also able to be like, this county seems to have a lot more violations than this county. So she was able to conceptualize it in terms of number to really be able to understand it on a kind of a deeper level, something that I wouldn't have been able to do on my own. So that was very helpful. And she was also able to kind of say to me, like, okay, what are these violations? What do they mean in terms of safety and the consequences of having these kinds of violations? And then we started to kind of say, well, if we're gonna be able to put a number to the violations that are occurring, we need to break it down a little farther. And then we came up with kind of our own definitions of the data we were looking at. So just take a step back a little bit. The state doesn't necessarily categorize violations in terms of type and severity, meaning, for instance, like rough handling a child isn't, being categorized as, oh, that's a very serious account. It would just fall under, say, positive child guidance, or not using positive methods of child guidance, or it could be categorized under a violations of child's rights. But other incidences like that could be categorized similarly. But it could also be something like a piece of rope being left in the facility that would be categorized as the same kind of violation, if that's making sense. So we wanted to kind of dig deeper and be like, okay, well, these are the violations that could pose a threat to child's health or welfare or the general cleanliness of his facility. And then these are the violations that, are more procedural violations that are occurring pretty frequently, but aren't necessarily gonna harm the child. To break it down a little bit more, to kind of get at a bigger issue. So that's kind of how we decided. We broke it down to health and safety violations and procedural violations. And those two categories kind of helped inform our numbers a little bit more. And Kate was able to tell me through that that there were almost 4,000 safety violations from 2021 onwards. And then similarly, that a lot of facilities, I think over 1,000 of the facilities, only had minor violations or no violations at all. So it really puts in context, the more severe facilities.
Yeah, I think that was a really, I know you guys spent a lot of time thinking about that division, and I think it was really useful because, not posting your fire drill or something is very different than having a pellet gun on the premises or having a gun that is not locked up. And I was kind of stunned by some of the violations that were, that you all found in terms of the safety violations. And I think it's important to distinguish between, like you said, violations that could potentially harm a child. And obviously there are reasons for, these other rules that exist on the procedural side, but they don't have that sort of immediate danger that some of these other do. And I know you and Kate put together this methodology page that you published, that we published alongside your story, which I think is really useful because it sort of walks readers through, a lot of what we're talking about here today, how you guys went through this data and designed the database. But it also includes a list of, what these procedural violations were and what these safety violations were. And so people can really clearly see that, like a refrigerator not being the right temperature is a procedural violation. An outdoor, the lack of shade outdoor, or some sort of records being missing, or missing a high school diploma of someone on staff. Those are all procedural violations. And then with the safety violations, staff are missing background checks. That seems a lot more serious. Or you were talking about the sanitary issues, all of that, children being restricted during nap time. Like this, there's this whole long list that people can see of what you all included in the safety violations and procedural violations. So I think that's really useful if people want to take a look at that.
Yeah, I think Kate coming up with that was finding the importance of writing out the methodology for people to really understand it was helpful, even for me when we were going about reporting out the story. But I think it's helpful for people to understand the differences of the two when they're looking at their childcare facility online.
Right. You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're here with Alexa Faust, who is a summer fellow at the Maine Monitor, and we're discussing violations at childcare centers across Maine. So, Alexa, we've talked a little bit about, how you all started organizing and categorizing this data. And obviously, that was a big piece of the reporting. What were you seeing, in terms of what violations really stood out to you, and what were you sort of most interested in terms of what you were seeing in these reports?
Yeah, I think what was most eye-catching to me was the facilities that seemed to have more of those repeat violations over time. And I'm not necessarily talking about the repeat procedural violations like missing immunization records, but the more safety-related ones that caught my eye. Like there was a facility called named Roots to Grow in Waterville that had. It was in Waterville. You should probably check that. But that had dozens of inspection reports related to the cleanliness of the facility, where the inspector was repeatedly citing them for the same violation over and over again, year after year. And then at one point, the inspector actually sent the children home because the facility was so dirty with piles and piles. I think the inspection report cites like 4 to 5 feet high. So incidences of that where the facility had reoccurring violations was interesting to see, and how the state went about issuing conditional licenses for certain facilities and the follow-up for that. I think at the beginning of their story, we talk about another facility that had similar repeat violations, not related to the cleanliness of a facility, but more about safety of the children on the premise. There was like instances of yelling and rough handling, and the provider body slamming kids against the ground and against cribs. And it wasn't just like one-off instance, and then the facility had no violations in the future. It seemed to be like more of a repeated occurrence. And so those were the things that really were like, whoa, these places are being cited and are being written up for these things that they have to post in their facility, but they are still licensed and they do have repeated violations. So those really stuck out to me. There's other facilities kind of in every county that have similar things. And we also found 13, I think it was 13 instances of guns or rifles or pellet guns or anything of that nature on the premise of childcare facilities and providers in the state. And now there is a difference between a facility and just a childcare provider, family childcare provider, where they're conducting childcare in their own home versus someone that has a licensed facility that you can go to. And if you're at a facility that is out of someone's home, you're allowed to have a gun on the premise, but it has to be locked up separate from their ammunition, somewhere else where children can't have access to it. But if you're at a licensed facility, you cannot have either. But there were 13 instances where there was some sort of violation, whether that be the gun was left out in view of children, or there was one instance where there was a rifle style BB gun waved in front of children at a facility, and the person was caught screaming and yelling threatening remarks at the kids. So those kind of repeated instances that were more serious stuck out to me, and kind of like the follow-up when those things occurred was also very interesting, because they were being cited, but obviously they are still open. And kind of then that made me want to talk to the parents involved in these situations to see, okay, were they made aware that this happened at the facility? Are they aware of things in the past that happened at their facility? What was the follow-up process like? So yeah, that made me really want to talk to the people that is actually affected through reading the reports. So
Yeah.
then, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I know you did talk to a lot of parents, and I know you also talked to and tried to talk to these childcare facilities. Not everyone was willing to talk. Before we and I want to hear about that. Before we talk about that, you've mentioned a few times that these conditional licenses, but you found in your reporting that the state also has the ability to revoke a license, right? And none of these cases was a license revoked. Is that right?
Yeah, none of the facilities we found through talking to the state that they had not revoked a single license since before 2021. We're not sure the exact date of when the last license revoking was, but they haven't done that since before 2021. And they said that what they have done since then is they have denied renewals. So licenses are only valid for, I think, 2 years, and then you have to go and get it renewed, and you have to apply for a renewal of license. So basically, the state was waiting for them to renew their license and go up for that inspection process again before deciding to deny that renewal, which is a little bit different than seeing that the facility has 10 violations for the same thing and deciding in the moment to take away the license. So the state was taking action, just more when they were up for that renewal. And then we also found that they had been taking away conditional licenses when those were up for renewal. So again, there was, I think it was 12 instances of the denial of renewals, but again, none were revoked. So it was just interesting to see that. And then when we asked the state to send us a list of the ones they had denied prior to 2021, we were given a list, and it was interesting to see how some of the facilities were denied a renewal of license for similar things that we were finding on inspection reports of currently operating facilities. So some were cited for, again, like the more safety violations and rough handling children or using derogatory remarks towards children. And their license was pulled at renewal. But then there were also other ones that had very small violations, or not small, but more procedural violations, and they were denied their renewal then. So it was interesting to get a comparison of what the state had done in the past and what was currently allowed to be open.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I think you also looked at the question of fines too, right? And found that they have the capability of issuing fines, but that in the time frame you looked at, there were no fines that were issued. Is that right?
Yeah, that was another thing that when we started filling out the database and we started to understand that you could issue a conditional license, you could deny a license, but what were the other ways that, what other ways could the state ensure that things didn't keep occurring? And they are allowed to issue fines, ranging from $50 for child rights violations to $500. For instances related to child staff ratio or disclosing confidential information and things of that nature. But when we asked the state, they said they had not fined a child care provider or facility since before 2021. And which is interesting, but then when we started to talk to more experts in the field about the child care crisis in Maine and the number, just the general decline in childcare providers in the state, it didn't seem like they most weren't advocating for these family-run providers to be fined when things occur because they're already operating on such a tight budget and a lot of them aren't making money and are barely floating above water that fining them might not necessarily help the situation, but instead just make them close down, which is not necessarily what the state needs right now. So it was kind of like an interesting dilemma to say, like, okay, this, well, the state's not fining them, but also, is that really what they should be doing if they're trying to bolster the childcare industry? And yeah, and then we kind of wanted to compare it to other states to see what they were doing in the same instances. And New Hampshire, we don't know for sure what they actually do, but in the regulations, their fines are much greater than they are in Maine. And they also have fines for repeated violations that are mounting. So, and Maine does not. So in New Hampshire, if something occurs once, it's one fine. But then if that is repeated, the fine increases over time. So it's just interesting to see that comparison across states.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I know you talked to DHHS and they said that, they see fines as sort of a punitive action that doesn't necessarily wouldn't necessarily lead to the kind of change they'd like to see, and that they're instead trying to focus on, technical assistance and support, and that's sort of what they've seen as effective in terms of ensuring compliance. But it is interesting, and you bring up, this broader context, which I'm sure, anyone in Maine who has a child and works or has needed to, get childcare knows, is that there is a big shortage of childcare providers and facilities in Maine. And, I've talked to a ton of people who are, just expecting, and they're already, on wait lists. I know people who were just calling different childcare providers every day to try to, see if they had, if their spot on the wait list had budged at all. I mean, I actually talked to someone a couple weeks ago who said, as soon as they got engaged, so years out from having
Oh my
children,
gosh.
they put themselves on a bunch of wait lists because there just really is a shortage of childcare providers in Maine. And you kind of get into that in the story a little bit, and how this is a particular crisis here, and that a lot of it had to do with COVID. Is that right?
Yeah, so in speaking to a lot of experts in the field, it kind of it the number of providers had has declined in since the COVID pandemic. And a lot of that stems from what they say is other fields increasing their wages. So people wanted to leave the childcare industry to get higher wages in other industries. But then also, obviously, the COVID pandemic brought out a lot of scrutiny into germs and not wanting to be around germs. And that was a big part. I mean, everyone knows, like, kids get sick a lot. So I think that was a big factor in people leaving the industry. But then it kind of causes this like cyclical nature of, okay, when there's not enough childcare providers because the pay isn't great. Well, if you increase the pay for them, then childcare goes up. And already in Maine and across the country, it childcare is so expensive. I mean, one of the quotes is that it's as much as your mortgage, which is crazy to think about. Some people just work to be able to afford to pay for childcare. So I think it's kind of a double-edged sword of how do we increase the skill set for those in the childcare industry to want to work there and to be providing high quality care, but then also make sure that we're not increasing the cost of childcare so that parents can actually afford to drop their kids off and feel good about it. So that has definitely been an issue. And through that, I think the state is trying to do more and has done more to help with that. They've done a couple different programs of funding for technical assistance and expanding and renovating facilities and advocating or giving the opportunity to staff to get more training and an expertise. And they've also done salary supplements so that they can help providers pay their staff more. There's also an increase in reimbursement rates for providers to be reimbursed. So they have done more to help kind of with the severity in the price of childcare and also the low wages that are given to staff.
Yeah, and I think you, in addition to talking to a lot of experts, I know you talked to a couple state legislators who are also following this issue. What did they have to say about this?
This was interesting to talk to. I think we talked to Senator Timberlake and some others about this and how this has kind of been an ongoing issue. And they have seen some change, but that we're not going to see greater change until we do more for it. And they have been on the Government Oversight Committee, which helps with these issues, like bringing forth recommendations to state government on what they can do to help the situation. And yeah, that was interesting to kind of get their perspective on it and know that it's like, okay, this is a big problem. It's not just something that we're seeing in the inspection reports, but something that the advocates and state government are actually trying to work towards a solution so that there aren't harmed children in the process. So that was good to hear the steps forward in that process.
Yeah, and I'm sure, one of the things that you and Kate worked on in putting together this story was putting together this database that you not only used internally for your reporting on the story, but that anyone can look at to just see how many safety violations, how many procedural violations, how many total violations there are at all of these childcare facilities across the state. And I think it seems like that could be something that would potentially be useful for these advocates and lawmakers to look at and just get a sort of holistic sense of where the problems are.
Yeah, when I talked to Senator Timberlake and others, I read through basically a list of some of the violations we had found to just try to give him an understanding of what I was looking at, and his like immediate response was that doesn't surprise me. So I think they are aware of what's going on, but having it in an accessible form that's like, okay, there's numbers to the issues is helpful. And I think we also heard a lot of that from parents in the childcare industry of wanting to know more about what's going on around them and knowing that they can access the database online, but it is not always the most user-friendly, or other parents not knowing that it's available. Like obviously it's public, but they might not have known beforehand that they did have access to their facility or their provider's previous inspection reports. Was also an interesting conversation to have with them of do they want to know all of these things and how would it be most helpful for them when making a decision on where to send their kid?
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a really, really important piece of the story is obviously the parents who are, entrusting these childcare providers and facilities with their children, and in some cases paying a lot of money for this care. And of course, the most important thing is that their kids are going to be safe. How did you go about finding parents to talk to for the story? And yeah, tell us about what those conversations were like.
Yeah, I think this was probably one of the harder parts of reporting out the story, but also it wouldn't have been a story without talking to all the parents, so most rewarding. But basically what I started to do was go on Facebook and look up, I think this was your suggestion, but look up different Facebook groups in the state of Maine that either city specific or childcare specific, or like moms of Saco, and posting in there. So I posted a very simple, just, "Hi, I'm a reporter. I'd love to talk to you about your experience in childcare," both from the provider perspective and from the parent perspective. And then I just kind of waited to see if people would be open to speaking with me. And at first, it was kind of a slow response. And then one parent after another kind of started to be like, "Yes, I would like to talk to you." I actually had some providers reach out to me through that, which was also very helpful because I think I knew I wanted to talk to the providers that I mentioned in the story that have these violations, but I also wanted to talk to the ones that were passing inspections one after the other to get their perspective on if these inspections are hard to pass. So by posting in the Facebook group, people seemed they could kind of put a face to a name and see me online and, feel more comfortable talking to me. And then we would hop on the phone and one parent would talk to me and then say, "Oh, there's another one of my friends you should talk to." And it kind of spiraled from there. But it was a great way to kind of connect and know that even if it's not specifically what I'm talking about, the more people we spoke to, the picture became clearer of what the actual issue was.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's funny how you can sort of make connections that way. And yeah, I have found that Facebook groups can actually be a great tool for reaching people. So what did you hear from parents when you started to talk to them? Did they have, stories of violations that they wanted to share? Were they aware of this inspection process at all? What did you hear?
So first I heard mostly that they knew that you could find inspection reports online. The general consensus for a lot of the initial families were that they were aware of it, but that they didn't know, they weren't really sure how to navigate the website, so they hadn't necessarily looked at previous violations. They just knew that they were there. And then I talked to one woman who had a story of an incident with her son at a facility where he couldn't talk to her about what was going on, but she basically discovered that her kid was being and other kids at the facility were being closed in the bathroom for periods of time as kind of a form of discipline. And she moved to the area recently. Her friend recommended that she go to this daycare facility. So she was kind of excited to be there with her friend and her kids be together. But once she started seeing her son act in like strange ways, he couldn't be left alone at night. He would any form of discipline, he would like run to the corner, and it really worried her. So she started speaking to other parents at the facility and learned that they were closing or she, were closing kids in the bathroom, and she filed a complaint with OCFS, the Office of Child and Family Services, and which is something that other parents didn't necessarily know to do. So that was kind of an interesting thing to know that they didn't know that they could file a complaint. And then the state went and investigated and found that what she thought was happening was occurring. But she was very She kind of echoed similar sentiments from other parents in that they were upset with the or frustrated with the lack of kind of follow-up from the state. They would file an a complaint to them and they would go investigate, but they hadn't, in their experience, reached out to them along the process to let them know how the investigation was going, what their findings were, what would happen to the provider. So that was a little frustrating for this woman and for some other parents that I talked to, and that they wanted to hear more. And even if the incident didn't involve their child, they wanted to be made aware through the process that this was going on at their facility so that they could kind of inform their kid and make an informed decision on whether or not they want to keep the kid there. Like this woman said, had I known that in 2020 my child was left alone unattended, a child was left alone unattended, I wouldn't have left my kid there to begin with. So just having kind of that open-ended communication between the state and the provider and the parent, like all along the process, is something that I think a lot of parents kind of advocated for through my conversations with them.
Yeah, and that's something you get at, toward the end of your story is that, there are some rules about how these facilities have to, have to report any sort of, if they fail an inspection, they have to put up a notice. Is that right? But it's just a, I think you have one of the parents in the story saying that, okay, there are 20 papers on a bulletin board or something, and this is one of them, and they're not really, being communicated in an appropriate way from the parents' perspective. Is that right?
Yeah, the inspection reports or investigations are just required to be posted in the facility. But, parents, when they're picking up their kid from daycare, aren't necessarily able to spend the time going through all the forms posted, or there might be a number of them and they aren't seeing them when they walk in to pick up their kid. So their biggest thing was that they wanted to be more directly informed of all violations, just to be made aware, even if they're something tiny like missing records or something. They just want to be made aware more directly and right away versus after the fact. I know there was a mom that I talked to that said that what she was told from the facility wasn't actually what happened in the instance of her child after the state inspected. So I think the biggest thing wasn't the incident itself. It was a lot of the communication that made things worse. And kind of like the lack of follow-up to know that things had been investigated for peace of mind, to know that they're not just being ignored, was also a big thing.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're here with Alexa Faust, who was a summer fellow at the Maine Monitor, and we are talking about safety and procedural violations at childcare centers across Maine. So, Alexa, we've talked a lot about what you found and sort of how you went about this process, and what the state said and what you were hearing from parents. What I know you reached out to a lot of childcare providers and facilities as well, some of whom, like you said, passed inspections and didn't have any trouble with that, and some of whom, are cited repeatedly, who we mention in this story for pretty serious violations. What was that like in terms of trying to get in touch with them, and what did you hear from these facilities?
That was also kind of an eye-opening experience, directly talking to some of the providers, one of which reached out to me directly on Facebook after I had posted. The owner of Tiny Tykes in Trenton, who has been written up for hundreds of violations over the last couple of years. And it was very informative to get her perspective on the inspection process and what that's like in the relationship between the licensing specialists at the State Department and the providers themselves, and what their communication is like. They a lot some providers were kind of echoed similar things to parents in that they wanted a little bit more communication between the licensing specialists and themselves, and a little more transparency about what's going on. And while the violation report, inspection report is very thorough, and they may find it hard sometimes to meet all of the guidelines, they like understand why they're all in place. So even though they have hundreds of violations, they get that they need to be there in order to ensure the safety of their children. And some of the other ones were that I was able to get in contact, like the facility Crips to Crayons that's mentioned in the beginning of the piece, echoed similar things of not having good communication with her licensing specialist and how it varies, depending on who's in charge of her inspections from year to year, and that there isn't that through line through all inspections, and that they may be written up for one thing one day and not the next day, which was frustrating for them to see because both of those facilities are family childcare providers, meaning they're offering childcare out of their home. And this is their main income. So that is something that they want to see in the future is better communication. And then we talked to the Down East Family YMCA, which is a larger facility run that has multiple locations throughout the state. And they were aware of all of their more safety violations that had occurred, and they had even been written up for safety violations relating to rough handling children that was documented on a video camera. So, it is substantiated, and they have since tried to take steps to ensure that it doesn't happen again, and that is installing more video cameras. That's having like a larger oversight committee to make sure that their staff is doing what they say they are doing. So I think in all, people don't go into childcare to do anything wrong. And having these conversations with them, kind of straightforward, and saying like, look, there's some bad things that you're being written up for, like the rifle style BB gun being waved in front of children. And talking to those providers and hearing their side of the story and how they're trying to take steps to make sure that it doesn't happen again, was good kind of peace of mind, as you're reporting out the story, that everything goes both ways.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. So what are, as you talk to experts and as you talk to these childcare providers themselves and as you talk to the state and sort of did all this research, I mean, what are some of the steps that these facilities can take to ensure that these, violations, particularly the really serious safety ones are not happening? Is it a matter of training? Is it a matter of, staffing ratios? I mean, what are really the places where where experts think that these facilities in the state need to focus on in order to prevent this from happening more frequently?
I think a lot of what we were hearing was staffing issues. There's a lot of repeated violations for child staff ratio, meaning they don't have enough staff for the number of children that they have in their care, which can lead to all sorts of violations. So a big thing that advocates were pushing for was doing more training, and so that they have more skilled staffing, so they're able to deal with all sorts of issues that may occur at their facility, but then also ensuring that they do have, competitive wages for these individuals because it's not easy to take care of children. So they want to make sure they're compensated as such, but then also making sure childcare is not as expensive. But those are some of the things the states, like I said before, are trying to act actively work on, by their funding. Doing higher reimbursement rates so that the providers can get better paid, offering training sessions are optional, but Rising Stars for Maine and Maine Roads to Quality are both programs that the provider and the facility can opt into to do more training. And there's different levels that they can rise up on, and different courses that they can take. And I know some of the providers that I had talked to that have, past inspections multiple times said that that's something that they try to advocate for their staff, kind of incentivize them to progress their career in childcare. So I think it comes from all ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's something, we're seeing across the state and in different, in the healthcare field too. There's a lot of emphasis on obviously nursing staffing ratios and on training and workforce development support there. So it's something that the state is trying to invest in sort of across the spectrum, not just in childcare. Well, we're kind of coming up against the end of the episode, but as a last question here, Alexa, what sort of new questions or ideas did this reporting leave you with?
I think the biggest thing for me is related to that funding is the state told us in our reporting that I think it's $30 million annually gets put into the childcare industry for so that programs can receive better funds. And I think I would like to understand more on how they decide, what's the decision process like behind who gets the money, what facilities and providers are getting the money. Do they have to meet certain requirements? And how is that tracked to ensure again that the providers are meeting the regulations that they need to and providing the highest level of care if they're given more state funding? So just tracking that money is something I want to answer more.
Great. Yeah, I think following the money is always a good that's always a good avenue.
Always good.
Okay, well, thank you so much for telling people about your story and your reporting. And for people who are listening out there who haven't had a chance to read it, I think there's the big investigation that people can read, or if they don't have as much time, you did some highlights, some three takeaways, so people can see that. And then we also have, I think, the methodology page online. And then of course there's the database that people can explore. So if people are interested in this, there's a lot out there for them to read on our website. So you've been listening to Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by Alexa Faust, who was talking about her reporting on childcare violations across the state. For more info on our work and how to support us, you can visit themainemonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Stephanie McPheeters, and this is Community Radio WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.